You've heard me talk for years about the breakthrough health benefits of CBD. Now, our friends at CV Sciences have developed an innovative suite of non-CBD products that mimic CBD's healthful effects. CV Sciences' new Plus Health CBD-free line of gummies and capsules. The Plus Health Clarity gummies are packed with DMAE, lion's mane, and rhodiola designed to boost your cognitive performance, enhance memory, and provide natural energy. You need a little peace and calm? Plus Health's Peace Gummies, soothing blend of L-theanine, lemon balm, and St. John's wort supports serenity and relaxation without the drowsiness. And if you're on a journey towards optimal health, the Reshape capsules are packed with powerful ingredients like berberine and OEA to support metabolic health and help maintain healthy blood sugar levels. For more information and to order, head over to pluscbdoil.com/Hoffman. Use coupon code Hoffman30. For 30% off. That's pluscbdoil.com/Hoffman for the new Plus Health non-CBD collection. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Robert Hoffman, continuing our discussion with Nicola Twilley, who's author of Frostbite, How Refrigeration Changed Our Food, Our Planet, and Our Cells. Nicola, I'm going to ask you maybe it's not a fair question. It's probably a real essay question, which is, has refrigeration caused the quality of our food to deteriorate? I mean, I endeavor to get fresh berries. I'm here in New York. They cost an arm and a leg. As the season gets colder and colder, I see the prices go up and up and up. And sometimes I succumb to frozen berries. And I'm told that they're the equivalent of fresh berries, but I'm not sure. What has your investigation revealed about the quality, the vitamin content, the nutrient content of frozen foods versus fresh foods?
Yeah, so in a lot of cases, even though it seems completely counterintuitive, frozen food will have more of its original nutrients in it than fresh food.
More.
Mm-hmm. And that is because it is chilled down so quickly and to such a low temperature that it does preserve more of those nutrients. Now, you know, with berries, it's a difficult compromise because the process of freezing, also it creates ice crystals, which damage cell walls. Mm-hmm. And that's why you get that slightly mushy texture to a frozen strawberry.
Like almost like a little sorbet kind of...
Yeah, it works great in a smoothie. Mm-hmm. It's not the same as a fresh strawberry. But it might have more nutrients than your Driscoll's pack that is being shipped across the country and spent several weeks, if not months, in a refrigerated warehouse. So that is something that people are always surprised about. But people have known since the very beginning, like refrigeration doesn't make produce better. It does not do anything to improve the quality of produce. What is happening once produce is harvested is it is dying. Like us, it has a limited number of breaths it's going to take before it dies. And all refrigeration does is slow that down. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's a funny thing. People will often buy a lot of fruits and vegetables because they want to have them on hand to eat healthy. Mm-hmm. And then it might be like a week, 10 days before they get to that bag of spinach, right? You know, you pat yourself on the back for eating it before it went slimy, and you should pat yourself on the back. But if you leave spinach in a fridge for a week, it loses 3/4 of its vitamin C. 13% of its thiamine. Like, you can run the numbers. Like, mm-hmm. people, so, you know, because it's still breathing and because it's not on the parent plant anymore, the only nutrients it has to draw on are the ones that are inside it. It's cannibalizing itself.
So just because it's not rotten or isn't going to give you ptomaine poisoning doesn't mean that some of the benefits have been vitiated by sitting in the refrigerator. Here we're talking about refrigeration, not freezing.
Exactly. And in those cases, that's where frozen spinach will actually retain more of those nutrients, because once it's frozen, that fruit or vegetable is not respiring anymore. It's not breathing. It's not metabolizing. And so it's not burning through those internal resources. So it's a funny thing. We think of fresh as healthier. That's not necessarily true.
I didn't realize this before reading your book, but refrigeration has a big impact on the quality of meat. And it's a very, very refined process by which they cool down. You know, they slaughter the animals, but in the slaughterhouse, they cool them down. And then, to my immense shock, excuse the pun, they zap the meat with electricity. Tell us about that.
I had no idea about this. And it's wild. I have been writing about and podcasting about food for decades at this point. I thought I knew what there was to know about.
I thought they just kill the animal and then, you know, cooled it down.
No. So, you know, and it's funny. Meat scientists have told me, you know, you think, oh, the breed of the cattle is important, or is it grass-fed, or everything about how the animal lived. So it's astonishing. But what happens is when an animal is slaughtered, the muscles, there's a whole series of processes going on with enzymes mm-hmm. and calcium in those muscles still after death. And the reason they zap it, it's a relatively recent innovation.
Although I understand that Benjamin Franklin pioneered the technique and then kind of wrote it off as kind of a novelty.
Many of his best inventions.
Right.
I always sneak Ben Franklin in wherever I can. I actually weirdly had a job many, many years ago working on the celebrations for his 300th birthday. So he's my main man when it comes to founding fathers. Right. And so I was delighted to see that he had figured out that if you zap a turkey, the meat is much more tender. And the reasoning behind that, and it's exactly why they zap meat today, is that when you slaughter meat and you cool it down very fast, you take it below 50 degrees, what happens is there's a little pump in your muscles that releases calcium and causes, you know, that contraction. Mm-hmm. And this happens like when you turn the page in my book, that was happening. It's a calcium pump that's doing that.
Right.
What happens is when you go below 50 degrees in the meat, internal temperature, not us standing outside in 50 degrees because we're mm-hmm. alive. But when the meat gets below 50 degrees, that pump fails and mm-hmm. it just floods the muscles with calcium. And that's the signal to contract. So the meat contracts and you can picture it, right? All that bunched up, contracted muscle is chewy and dense.
Sounds like rigor mortis.
Exactly. Normally when rigor sets in, all of that, like in the old days before we had powerful refrigeration, it would cool naturally and slowly and the calcium would be long gone by the time we got to that temperature.
Mm-hmm.
Now the calcium is flooding it. There's still energy in the muscles to contract. So it contracts and it's bunched up and it won't unbunch. Mm-hmm. And so that's what New Zealand scientists discovered this. It was a huge problem in the industry. They were finding they couldn't cool meat quickly enough to move it through the production line without it getting chewy and dense. They called it cold shortening.
So they had to zap it to short circuit that physiology.
Exactly. Because mm-hmm. if you zap it, the muscles will have run out of energy to contract because they've contracted so many times while you're giving it this electric mm-hmm. shock. Mm-hmm. But when the calcium pump fails, as it will do once it gets to 50 degrees, it will put out that signal to contract, but it will fall on deaf ears because the muscle has already run out mm-hmm. of energy because it's had this big spasm from the electric shock.
So that's the science behind that. So when I go to like a really fancy steakhouse, they make a big deal out of, you know, sometimes they'll have a display, you know, through a glass window, you can see these large slabs of meat, you know, hanging down like in the movie Rocky, you know, when he goes into the cold freezer and starts punching the meat. That's what's called dry aging, and it's supposed to impart like a really good flavor. Like the way you cool, the way you preserve the meat has an impact on the flavor, the texture, tenderness, and so on. But now there's this new thing that you talk about called wet aging, which is not as arduous a process. And so there's this argument back and forth, which is the best way to make the tenderest, most succulent steak.
Totally. And, you know, obviously wet aging is cheaper. It sounds disgusting. They don't use it as a selling point. Dry aging sounds lovely. Wet aging sounds sort of gross. And that's why you don't
you see put it in a plastic bag, basically. And
yeah, and it, leave it to sit in its own juices in the cold. And right. So that means you can do the aging while you're shipping it around the country and while it's sitting there on the grocery store shelf. And you're not paying for the time that it sits there.
Warehousing it, in effect. Aging. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You're saving so much warehouse time and, you know, all the effort of dry aging, which is a sort of expert process. And so, yeah, wet aging, the same sorts of reactions take place. So what happens is the enzymes are breaking down the muscle. You're breaking it down into the proteins into smaller, more flavorful amino acids and sugars. Your own. Like pockets that will trap the juices while it's cooking. You know, the fat is oxidizing a little, which gives it a different kind of fatty acid profile. Some of those nutty notes you might get in a really nice steak. Mm-hmm. So that's what's happening in the muscle. And those reactions are going on, whether it's aging in a vacuum sealed bag of its own juices or on a shelf in a, you know, dry aging warehouse in the most exquisite restaurant. It's just that they are slightly different because one's happening in a vacuum and one's happening in oxygen. And so you get slightly different flavor notes at the end. So some people say the flavor of wet aged meat, if you eat it next to dry aged meat, you can pick up more of a metallic note. Some people say it's like sort of serum-y, which I don't even know what that is. Other people can't notice it. I mean, I think it's to do with, you know, listen, if you're having like just a burger on the grill and you're mostly tasting the charcoal, you're not going to pick this up. If you're having an exquisite, rare, you know, steak and you're really focusing on the flavor notes, yes, you will taste it. But yeah, wet aging is what revolutionized the industry and is basically what allows us to have the cheapest meat in the world now.
By the way, side note, the price for a high-end New York sirloin steak in a New York steakhouse is now $75. And it could
be
more,
unreal.
You know, it could be more depending on where you go. But, you know, then I rationalize that expenditure because when you buy beef, it's so expensive these days that even if you prepare it at home, the meat itself is about $35. It's very expensive. I just wanted to ask you, you know, I'm puzzled by modern refrigerators because they have all these compartments and, you know, I don't think I'm optimally utilizing all these compartments. It says you're supposed to put certain things in some compartments and you put some things at the top of the refrigerator, some things at the bottom of the refrigerator. In your research, did you gain any insights on that help you become a better consumer?
Yeah, so this is an ongoing source of confusion in the world. You are not alone in your sense of sort of like, what am I supposed to put in each compartment? And listen, don't beat yourself up about this because it's really a very flawed attempt to recreate the very specialist conditions you get in warehouses.
In warehousing, where they really fine-tune it to, you know, precise humidity. They even modify the gas concentrations within these hermetically sealed warehouses and, of course, temperature.
I mean, listen, it's like I ended up thinking about these fruits and vegetables, for example, like pop stars with super fussy writers, like different varieties of apple. Take a Red Delicious versus a Honeycrisp. Mm-hmm. They have different requirements for exactly the atmospheric blend, for exactly the humidity, the temperature. So, and where, you know, if you have a warehouse full of apples, you're going to dial it in and get it exactly right. They have the most sophisticated anti-aging technology out there for these apples. The apples themselves are controlling the atmosphere in these warehouses and modifying it exactly according to their needs. Your home fridge can't do that. You know, like KitchenAid or Whirlpool or whatever, they don't know if you're buying a Honeycrisp or a Red Delicious. They don't even know if you're buying apples. Are you putting apple? And then are you putting them in the crisper drawer? Who knows? So it's a very, you know, in a produce person would never dream of putting berries and apples in the same space. You would just not do that. Mm-hmm. We have to do that in our home fridge. And so that's why they give you all these different compartments in an attempt to say, okay, you can put apples in these ones. You can put berries in this one. There's a little more humidity. Mm-hmm. You can put, you know, And it's a reflection of the fact that our food actually likes very different kinds of environments. Cheese likes a little humidity. It hates the dryness of our home fridge. But our home fridge has to work for, you know, meat as well. And it has to work for produce as well. So because it has to, it's a one size fits all. The compartments are an attempt to kind of fudge things a little and give you at least a little diversity in terms of environments.
Did you gain any insights into what foods that are, you know, we tend to shove everything in the refrigerator. I mean, I used to live in a, you know, kind of a tenement apartment. I kept everything in the refrigerator basically to keep the roaches away. But certain foods are maybe not suitable for the refrigerator. For example, you know, you put bananas in the refrigerator, bad news, they'll brown right away. I'm not sure why that is. Maybe you can explain it, but maybe there's some foods that, you know, don't deserve being shoved into this, what we consider a generalized food receptacle.
There are huge numbers of foods that do worse in the refrigerator. So potatoes and onions are two of them in the cold. There are reactions that break down the carbohydrates into sugar, so they get a nasty sweet note. Don't do that. Potatoes can actually make toxins in the cold. So it's a really bad idea to do that. Bread or cakes, like those kinds of things people put in the fridge, and that dries them out. It's a very dry environment. So if you like dry cake, put it in your fridge. If you don't. And so I think there's a lot of sense. You know, a lot of people put a lot of things in the fridge because they feel like it won't be safe if it's out. And that's just not true. I mean, butter will be safe to eat if it's out. It might just oxidize more quickly and go rancid.
It could go rancid. Yeah, I'm saying that in hot weather it will rancid. But also, it's much more spreadable when you leave it out, as long as you have a relatively cool apartment.
And if you leave out what you're going to use in the next day or two, then it won't go rancid. Again, depending on where you are in the country and how hot your apartment is, et cetera. So I think there's a lot of people are afraid their food will go bad. So they put it in the fridge when it doesn't necessarily need to be there. That's one thing, you know, and then and it's definitely, you know, like, for example, with your berries or whatever, the goal is just not to have them in the fridge for very long. Like, it's not a good environment for them. So buy them and then eat them. Don't keep them sticking around. If you are not going to eat your berries quickly, or you want a constant supply of berries on hand because you always have them in a smoothie or whatever, that's where your frozen berries are your friend. But yeah, bananas hate the refrigerator, and it's because they have been... So when you buy a banana in the store, it's been shipped under refrigeration, but then it is ripened. They blast it with a hormone, called ethylene. It's plant hormone, and they blast it with that over a sort of 48 to 72 hours.
It's a gas, ethylene.
Yeah. And very explosive, which is why in the early days, before people got a handle on it, banana ripening room explosions were very common.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, passersby would be buried in a hail of bananas.
I understand that bananas actually, they exhale some ethylene that communicates to adjacent bananas that it's time to ripen. It's kind of a weird, like, plant communication thing, isn't it?
That's what ethylene is. It's basically... a plant hormone that says it's time to move on to the next stage of our existence. Wow. So in bananas, it will ripen. If you spray ethylene, and I've seen this done in Hawaii, if you spray ethylene on a field full of pineapples, they all start to form flowers. Oh. So you can just, that's how you make sure your pineapple field all fruits at the same time, as you blast it with ethylene, and then it all flowers and fruits at the same time. So it has different effects on different fruits and vegetables. It's a sort of universal plant hormone that says, time to move on to the next stage in your life, young plant. But yeah, once it's been ripened, it can't be refrigerated, a banana, because it's called, what did they call it? Well, now I can't remember. But basically, the flesh is now, it will turn gray. It will turn hard. Mm-hmm. Once it's been brought to ripeness, it cannot be refrigerated, which is why we have to ship them when they're green and ripen them to order, you know, just before they're sold. You can't ship a ripe banana, which is why for most of human history, we didn't have bananas.
You can ripen them and then freeze them, and then they're a treat for kids. So, you know, that's...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah. And if your bananas are going bad and you don't have time to make a banana cake, that's the trick. That's what to do. Freeze them.
Indeed. Okay, so when you freeze something, I mean, they literally have come up with the remains of mammoths in permafrost in Siberia that are pretty well preserved. So what about that dish that I made, you know, like maybe I made Thanksgiving stuffing and I had too much stuffing back in 2022 and I stuck it into some Tupperware and put it in the freezer. And now I'm, you know, digging, you know, I do kind of a, you know, like a anthropological
freezer archaeology,
archaeological excavation in my freezer. And I find it has it deteriorated? I mean, it's not going to be toxic, but has that long freezing caused it to lose its mojo?
The only thing that will have happened is that it will have dried out a little. Again, it's a very
freezer
dry environment.
So-called freezer burn.
You know? Freezer burn. So it will have dried out. That can be worse or you know, it depends on the thing. If you're freezing bread, you know, after a certain point, it really will not be in great shape anymore. And so the extent of the damage sort of depends on how important the moisture is. The other thing is if there are variations in temperature in your freezer, which can happen. So if you get slight melting, slight refreezing, mm-hmm. that can really damage the texture. But
yeah.
otherwise,
or if you live in a place where there's like blackouts occasionally, power
exactly.
failures, you know.
Mm-hmm. But otherwise, no, it's going to be absolutely fine. It's definitely not going to kill you. It will not necessarily have improved, but it may well be undamaged. And if it's damaged, it'll be in one of those ways.
So let's talk about some of the downsides of this revolution in refrigeration. How has refrigeration harmed small, independent, local farm-to-market growers and resulted in kind of the consolidation of agribusiness into big, big industrial concerns?
Yeah, this is a really interesting aspect of refrigeration. And you obviously can't blame refrigeration for, you know, all of these things. But the problem with refrigeration is that it's expensive, and it only makes economic sense at a certain scale. And so that's why you get this sort of aggregation of, you know, if you're going to build a refrigerated warehouse, well, now you need to slaughter enough animals to fill that refrigerated warehouse. And so that means you need to have, you know, then you need that many, you know, animals on hand nearby to do that. And so then you start getting feedlots with, you know, sewage lagoons, et cetera. So it has a sort of ripple effect of scale. You can see this in the developing world really easily. So for the book, I went to Rwanda, which is a country that doesn't have a refrigerated food system right now and where they're really trying to build one. And talking to folks who actually their company had a specific mission to work with smallholders. Really, these mm-hmm. are tiny, tiny, tiny farmers. You know,
do it the right way and, you know,
exactly.
Create an advance, but not dispense with the good in the economy.
Exactly. And they were saying, no, we can't make this work economically for the smallest farmers. And so, for example, next door in Kenya, where the government has really focused on refrigeration, actually, you get now a situation where, yes, it's been successful and perishable foods have overtaken tea and coffee as Kenya's big export moneymakers, but it's 8 really large white-owned farms, not the smallholders who can't afford the system, can't afford to run it, you know, and who lose out in the end because then a richer farmer does land and displaces them. And not everyone wants to stay on the farm. And it's also not as if there's not ways to work around this. So some of the folks I was talking to in Rwanda were saying, well, there's a co-op method, for example. Do we get the, you know, you have to scale up somewhere in the system to afford refrigeration, but could we make it so that smallholders can stay on their land if they want to, if we do this thoughtfully? That's not what happened in the U.S. So definitely it has had this sort of scale effect. It has also reduced the biodiversity of our diets in a lot of ways we talked about. There's a lot of emerging research on, you know, what it has done to our gut microbiome that I find genuinely fascinating. Mm-hmm. The pre-industrialization gut microbiome as we know from looking at sort of hunter-gatherer gut microbiomes today, is a lot more diverse.
Well, yeah, part of the reason is that freezing food and preserving food and processing food has rendered our food more sterile. And we're not introducing some of the natural microbes from our environment, you know, some obviously deadly and pathogenic, but some may be integral to maintaining a balanced, diverse microbiome.
And think about how important fermentation and various pickling methods and
right.
those kinds of...
Which used to be the only game in town.
Exactly. And which are so important for a beneficial gut environment, but that we're now not dependent on. We can have fresh milk whenever we want it. We don't mm-hmm. have to have kefir or buttermilk or whatever, mm-hmm. you know? So or yogurt, you know, our milk is fresh. So, because it's refrigerated. So it's a really interesting, you know, I have a sort of entire section of the book looking at like, what are the pros and cons in terms of health? And then when you go outwards from that and the pros and cons environmentally,
right.
immediately
I was going to ask you about that because
climate change.
Paradoxically, yeah. you were refrigerating everything, but we're also heating up the planet to a large degree. And, you know, we tell people to get, you know, EVs, but a big part of the energy equation is the amount of energy expended to create refrigeration on a massive scale.
It's huge. It's very... For a long time, it wasn't discussed. So, for example, you always hear about aviation, you know, planes, terrible for the environment. Mm-hmm. Well, the cooling for food, emissions for cooling food have actually recently exceeded those for aviation. So,
wow.
But you don't hear that. No one's like, oh, gosh, you should unplug your fridge. And nor am I saying you should unplug your fridge. But in a world where, in fact, most of the rest of the world hasn't built a U.S.-style refrigeration, you know, system for its food, Europe has, sure. China still hasn't reached that level. India still hasn't reached that level. Sub-Saharan Africa, which is adding a billion people, you know, over the next 30 years, that's the expected population growth. They haven't built one, but they're looking to build one. If all of those people build a U.S.-style refrigeration system, and it's already a bigger emission source than aviation, we are we're toast. As one expert put it to me, well, we'll have all this refrigerated space and no harvest to put in it because of climate change, because we simply cannot cool our food the same way we do right now for a planet of 9 billion. It's just not possible.
So in the book, you propose some innovative solutions, you know, perhaps also improving the energy efficiency of our current refrigeration methods, but also some innovative techniques to help to prolong the shelf life of foods or enable them to be transported over longer distances without refrigeration. There's a company called Apeel, APEEL, that's exploring that possibility.
Yeah, there's some really interesting work out there. And what's funny is people are kind of resistant to it because they're like, oh, no, it has to be refrigerated to be fresh.
Yeah.
And they get sort of grossed out by the idea that you could preserve food any other way. And that's when I say to them, listen, when your, you know, great grandparents first encountered refrigerated food, they didn't think it was fresh. This is a very action to a new method of food preservation. Like the meaning of freshness, people specifically thought that, you know, a refrigerated chicken couldn't be fresh.
Yeah.
It was zombie
food. That it was dead,
you know?
Devitalized and so on, yeah.
Exactly. And now we think there's no way that, you know, there's one company I didn't put in the book but is working on a supercritical carbon dioxide pasteurization techniques. That means we would be able to ship red meat or any meat, you know, white meat around the world without refrigeration. And, you know, when I say that to people, they're like, but that's disgusting. and I say, listen, you know, 100 years ago, you would have thought that about the refrigerated meat. So at least hear it out. At least have a thought about, you know, in the book, I sort of talk about this at length. Like, what does fresh even mean? Does fresh mean it has more of the nutrients in it that it had while it was alive that we want to consume? Well, in that case, maybe you need to redefine what you know, maybe the fridge is not the best tool for the job in all cases. So
indeed.
Yeah. And Yeah. And if a peel, for example, could help us eat a more diverse range of fruits, because we could eat all those glorious tropical fruits that don't work in the cold right now, that we can never get unless you go on vacation and you try them there, you know, wouldn't that be great? We could have a whole different, more biodiverse diet. And without the energy that's being used to cool it at the moment. So who knows?
Well, this is but a teaser of the vast amount of information that you can glean from the book that we're discussing. The book is Frostbite, aptly titled, How Refrigeration Changed Our Food, Our Planet, and Ourselves. The author is Nicola Twilley. She's also a co-host of the award-winning Gastropod podcast, which takes a similar look at other phenomena related to our food intake. You really have the highest regard for the tenacity with which you've tackled this subject. It really, you've done an enormously deep dive on all aspects that touch upon refrigeration. And I think the book is great practical import for everyone who lives in this world and also is concerned about their food intake. So it's a great, great resource.
I really appreciate that. Thank you. It's great to hear.
Indeed. Well, thank you very much for joining us. That's Nicola Twilley. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.
I want to thank you for listening to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or your favorite podcast app, and get new episodes automatically downloaded every weekday. And please give us a rating and review. It truly helps new people discover Intelligent Medicine. The Intelligent Medicine Podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice, and no doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of information on this podcast or materials linked from this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice for any medical condition they may have, and should seek the assistance of their healthcare professionals for any such conditions. Finally, please visit drhoffman.com and discover everything Intelligent Medicine has to offer, including frequently updated, unbiased health news and fully vetted product and supplement recommendations. There were many important reasons why I started my FullScript online supplement dispensary. I wanted to offer you the same curated professional-grade supplement brands that I use, the ones I know and trust. I also wanted to ensure that they weren't counterfeit or expired. Recently, I've been hearing more and more about counterfeit or expired products purchased from online retailers. With FullScript, you can be confident your supplements are genuine and they'll arrive with optimal freshness and potency. Also, buying through FullScript offers fast shipping, optional refill reminders, and a highly rated mobile app. It's safe, secure, HIPAA-compliant, and offers world-class support. Go to drhoffmanstore.com for more information and to start your free FullScript account. You'll get access to the supplements and features you need to help you achieve your wellness goals, including my custom targeted protocols that combine the products I recommend to address specific needs, heart health, immune support, and much more. To get started, just go to drhoffmanstore.com, drhoffmanstore.com.